welcome to Veterans Radio, America's number one Veterans Radio program, with today's host, award-winning author, and our special friend with his At Ease program today on Veterans Radio, Dwight Zimmerman.
Hi there, Dale.
Good morning, Dwight, and welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you so much, Dale. It's great to be here again. By the way, I heard, excuse me, I've got a little frog in my throat, so listeners, please, my apologies if suddenly I get hoarse here. But Bob and Dale, I understand that you had a big veterans event in Detroit this week. Can you tell us about it?
Well, I will, Dwight, and... Yeah, of course, we remember that one, the Silhouettes and Get a Job, and everything was about jobs in Detroit for 3 days this past week. Dale, I, and Nina, we converged for a Vets for Jobs conference. Dale, I was floored as to how much was going on.
Yeah, it was an amazing program, and this is a part of the Veterans Administration's roadshow, I guess you could call it.
Yeah.
And we had 3 full days. We had everybody there from the Veterans Affairs Department, the head of the director, Shisecki. Congressman, statesman, every PR person from the VA. They had everything you ever wanted
to know
about the Veterans Affairs Office, jobs. They had clinics there for giving physicals. They were helping homeless. They handed out chits so that people could get housing. They had jobs. The day we were there, 250 people were offered jobs.
Jobs, 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 jobs. This is your VA, your Veterans Administration Department, helping you. Guys, you know, I hear a lot, oh, man, I don't know where to go, man. Well, this was the beginning, and they're going to be all over the country. Dale, how are they going to find out where the other ones are going to be?
Well, I just have to go to the VA website, that's va.gov, for one thing, but their next big show is coming up in Chicago in September, and that one is co-sponsored by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So there were at least 10,000 veterans wandering around.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
wandering around in organized military fashion around Cobo Hall.
Yeah. They weren't milling around, as you used to always. Don't quit that milling around.
On Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. But the thing that impressed me the most was the organization that the VA had put this whole program together, and they had so many options. They had manufacturers. They had employers from all over the country, not just the Detroit area. They had franchisers there offering you franchises with Big Boy or Two Men in a Truck or Little Caesar's Pizza, or I can't even name all the different franchises that were there.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob and I both agreed that if you wanted to get a job and you walked out of there without an offer,
you weren't trying
very hard.
And the best part, all you veterans out there will understand this, it was fun. Veterans are fun. I couldn't quite put my finger, I mean, it was a long, long, long days. Everybody was working and schmoozing, but they were fun. Veterans. There were lines that were so long. It was like the first day there in boot camp, and there it was, man, the mess hall. But nobody complained. No, I mean that. Nobody.
No.
No, there was not a discouragement. They just stood in line, waited your turn, got taken care of, boom, and you're in.
And we want to congratulate the Department of Veterans mm-hmm. Affairs for that program. And again, this was a test case, and they were so excited about what they got as far as their results that they are taking it on the road around the country. So check with your local VA, wherever it happens to be, and find out where their next job traveling show is going to be.
Bingo.
All right. Thanks, Dwight, for giving us a little time.
Thank you, Dwight. Take it over.
Okay. Well, there's been a lot of activity with the Supreme Court this past few days, and one thing in particular that has been a big issue with veterans, and I have to say with myself, too, since I wrote about this, the Supreme Court has struck down the Stolen Valor Act, And next week, we will be talking about that, its implication and what can be done to get a new version, one that will pass muster. So be here next week on Veterans Radio to listen to a special on the Stolen Valor Act.
Absolutely, Dwight. And as you mentioned, we are all upset by this. We understand that people have a tendency to exaggerate, embellish their war stories sometimes, but you know, don't be going around claiming that you won certain awards or you received certain awards and using them for profit. That's the thing that you and I talked about, and that's what you and Bob are going to be talking about next week on Veterans Radio. We're going to be doing a special report. I need a little music in the background.
Oh, yeah.
On the Stolen Valor Act, and we're going to go back and look at our program that we did on Stolen Valor. I believe it was in 2006 or 2007.
Yes. Okay, and we will be talking to our first guest, Kathleen Rogers, about her book, The Final Salute, after a short break that we'll be taking in just a moment here. Very excited about this. We have two very fine guests, Kathleen, as I just mentioned, and Carol Joes, whose book, You Are Not Forgotten, is about a family's quest for truth and the founding of the National League of Families and the fight that they've done to get accountings for POWs and MIAs. Everyone, you know, stay with us. And if you want to call in, please feel free to do so at 877-573-7825.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Listening to At Ease on Veterans Radio Network. I'm your host, Dwight John Zimmerman, and I'm happy to welcome on board my first guest today, Kathleen Rogers, whose award-winning novel, The Final Salute, tells the story of Lieutenant Colonel Tuck Westerfield. He's an A-10 pilot, career Air Force officer on the cusp of promotion and senior command, a loving husband and devoted father of three who, while struggling to deal with the shock of his best friend's death in an aircraft accident, finds himself in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong person when he stumbles upon his commanding officer in the middle of an affair with his female XO. What happens next is a series of escalating and emotionally wrenching actions and decisions that not only threaten Tuck's career, but also his marriage. Kathy, welcome to At Ease.
Hi, Dwight. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, that's my pleasure. Well, you wrote a very, very powerful story with Final Salute, and I, as I understand, it took you several years to write this, correct?
Yes, I started it in 1992, right after my husband Tom retired after 20 years of flying fighters. And, you know, I was able to finally, not being an active duty wife, I was able to write the kind of story that I really wanted to tell after my husband retired, because one of the themes in the story is a sex scandal, and I could not have written that when my husband was still active duty.
What aircraft did your husband fly?
For 12 years, he flew the A-10, the Warthog, and before that, he flew the F-111.
Okay. Now, your story opens with a pilot's death, and it ends with a pilot's death. You know, was there a special reason for this sort of symmetry?
I guess in a way, the death, you know, two bookends. One of the themes, the most serious theme in the novel, is the death of fighter pilots during peacetime crashes. There's a bit of a war, the first Gulf War, in my novel, but the reason I chose this theme is in real life, my husband lost so many friends in both the F-111 and in the A-10 in peacetime training missions. And everybody thinks about when fighter jets go down or get shot down in war, but, oh, my gosh, I can't tell you how many friends that we both lost in peacetime training missions. So that was a theme that I wanted to explore that I thought wasn't written about enough, and I wanted to come in on the human element, the human side of it. I wanted to write a story that wasn't so much about the jets and the, you know, mechanics of it, but the human element.
And speaking of that human element, when Tuck stumbles in on this situation, suddenly he becomes involved in a cover-up, and there's enormous pressure put on him by his commanding officer and other people involved in it. And what fascinated me was the fact that he couldn't say anything about it, not even to his wife.
Yes, you know, he was told to keep his mouth shut by his commanding officer, who was a full colonel. And as you know, Dwight, because you've read my book, it went all the way up the chain of command to a three-star general. And I will just tell you this, without saying too much, that I based the sex scandal on a true story. And I changed the names and changed things to protect the innocent and to, I guess, protect the guilty.
Okay. A big share of the story deals with family life and family members, you know, spouses and the kids who are military brats of service personnel. They exist in a special world of their own. You know, they're basically a group of outsiders amongst a larger group of insiders. You know, I was really impressed at how well you were able to tell their stories, particularly the helplessness a spouse can suffer. Like what happens to Tuck's wife, Gina, who's trying to break him out of his shell, and she's completely helpless about it.
Yes. You know, I live that, too, as the wife of a fighter pilot, and that's what I wanted to give to my character, Gina, and the other wives, and also the children. You know, when you, like, for instance, when we lived on a military base, I did not wear the uniform. But you know what? As the wife of a fighter pilot, I served too. I just didn't. My name was not on the paycheck. My children were young, but they were military brats, and it's a whole different subculture when your husband or wife, when your spouse is in the military, you are part of that. Especially when you live either on post or base, you know, everything is around the military. Revolves around the mission, and whether you're going to the commissary to get your groceries, to the hospital to take one of the kids to the emergency room, the school that's on a military installation. And I really wanted to bring in the family. I wrote a lot of stories for Air Force, Army, and Navy Times years ago before I worked on my novel, and those were the things I wanted to read about. Military families, I didn't think I got enough of that when my husband was active duty. And that's also one of the things I wanted to bring into the novel. I wrote this novel because it was the story I was hungry to read. And when I couldn't find it, I had to write it.
That sounds like a lot of writers that I know, including me, where you say, well, I guess I'm just going to have to buckle down and do it.
Yes.
Another refreshing aspect of your book was how you depicted the interrelationships of the various spouses and families. You know, it's a small-town atmosphere, as it were. You wrote some very rich characters. I particularly enjoyed Winona, the beauty product representative. She's woven throughout the story and starts out as something of an enemy and winds up having a surprising and supportive pivotal role near the end.
Oh, thank you. Winona is one of my favorite characters, Winona Sanford. She's a Purple Passion beauty consultant. She drives a customized purple Suburban, and some folks say she looks more like a hooker than an officer's wife. Winona came to me as a gift because her husband is a civil engineer, and they don't like pilots, and they live right next door to a pilot. And I had a lot of fun playing Winona off with Tuck. They were enemies, and it all started out with a dog incident, with the dog using the bathroom in Tuck's yard. But Winona's the type of person where you can't judge a book by its cover. And, you know, you can see people on the street. We can see them in school, in church, you know, wherever we go. And they may look one way, but you never know what's going on inside, or if we don't know their hearts. And that's what Winona brings to the story. She may kind of look like a floozy, but she has a heart of gold. But it takes Tuck a while to see that, and even Tuck's wife, Gina.
Michelle, Tuck's teenage daughter from a previous marriage, when we meet her for the first time, she appears in full-blown teenage rebellion, wearing attire that makes the New York City punk and goth crowd that I've seen here look like a Southern Baptist church choir in comparison.
Michelle, yes, Michelle, Tuck's daughter from his previous marriage to a woman named Sally who hated the military. When Michelle shows up, you're right, she comes off that airplane and she's got the gothic makeup and she's wearing combat boots. Now, for anyone who's read the story, the combat boots are so symbolic of Tuck's teenage daughter, why she wears the boots. He doesn't even realize the symbology until she has to leave. But I had a lot of fun with Michelle's character because, again, she also came to me as a gift. In the middle of a military story, here comes this teenager into this family, and what she brings makes me cry because she, again, is another one. You can't judge a book by its cover. You know, here's this teenager shows up in full-blown goth paint on her face, her attire, and again, her story unfolds, and we start to learn, you know, her heart, who she's, why she is the way she is, why she's rebellious, and then what happens later. And anyone that's read the story knows that that's where Winona, our Purple Passion beauty consultant, comes in to the rescue.
Yes, in a very charming way, but I won't give that one away because it's a poignant and amusing incident that readers will get a kick out of. But
yes,
of course, the real story here is Tuck.
Yes.
Tell us about how all this happened and how he wound up finding himself in this mess and how he was dealing with it.
Tuck, at the opening of the story, without giving too much of the plot away, but Tuck has just gotten a call. He's been flying fighters for 19 years. The story opens a brief prologue where he's at pilot school. On the first day of pilot school, the colonel comes into the room, into the briefing room, and says, in 20 years of flying, look to the guy on your right and the guy on your left. In 20 years of flying, one of you will be dead. And the guy sitting next to Tuck is a guy named Jeff Sweeney, whose call sign is Swing Dog. So 19 years later, Tuck has gotten the call that Swing Dog has been killed in an F-111 in England across the pond. And he's grieving, but here's what I tried to do with the fighter pilots. And I lived this with my husband and all his buddies. Fighter pilots cannot show their emotion. They can't afford to because they have a very dangerous job. So what Tuck does is he zips up those emotions when he zips up his flight suit each day to go to work. And this is where we find Tuck. He is grieving. He stayed a little too late at the officers' club, had a few too many beers, and he cannot drive. So he lives on base. So he's stumbling home about midnight. and he's talking to Swing Dog's ghost. And he's also, the other thing I dealt with in this book through Tuck's character is survivor guilt. Tuck has lost so many friends in aircraft mishaps, and he's still alive. And so not only does he grieve his friends, but he doesn't know how to show it. He also is suffering from survivor guilt. And then he stumbles onto the wing commander and the female executive officer, and then that's the cover-up. But my challenge as a writer and as a woman, I'm a woman and my main character is a man, and I thought, how am I going to write from the male point of view and be realistic? And so here's what I did, Dwight. I gave myself permission to write in the male viewpoint, to become Tuck, and to make the story authentic. And that gave me the authority I needed to make my character come alive. And, you know, I'm not a pilot. I was not active duty. But I used my imagination and my life experiences living with fighter pilots. And I understand from readers that, you know, Tuck is a very real to them.
Well, that's a great testament to how you managed to pull it off. Well, the enormous pressure is not only put on Tuck, but also on his family. These people participating in the cover-up are playing some real dirty pool here.
Yes.
Which throws Tuck into even greater anger. And, you know, finally, from what I saw, because he loves the Air Force, he would love to stay in the Air Force, but at one point he just reaches his Rubicon and says that the only way he can save his honor, his sanity, and his marriage is to retire.
Yes, go ahead.
No, and that scares the people in the cover-up.
Yes, because they get scared because when they realize, okay, so Westerfield, Tuck's going to retire, well, what does he have to lose when he retires? Well, he can blow the whistle, you know. So they try to offer him, you know, the prime job, and they dangle the, you know, the carrot in front of him. And around this same time is when Saddam Hussein, when he invaded Kuwait. And as we all remember, that was on August 2nd of 1990, and everything in the world changed. All of a sudden, people are like, Kuwait? Where's Kuwait? And I was guilty of that, too. I'd never heard of Kuwait. So I gave that to my character, Gina. And then that's where the whole story shifts to everything's the mission, the deployment, the pre-war, the prelude to the war. And all this is still happening where Tuck's wife, Gina, she still doesn't know why Tuck is acting so strange. She thinks it's all still just because of the death of Swing Dog. She has no idea the amount of pressure Tuck's been under on this cover-up. And there's a young lieutenant, Wheaties, in the story, and he's kind of on to something's going on, but he's not privy to the information. But he's another player in the story and one of my favorite characters.
When Tuck is deployed to Saudi Arabia, you shift your narrative and begin telling the story through an exchange of letters between various people. Why did you choose this?
I love the letter form. And in real life, you know, this was 20-something years ago. No emails, no cell phones, long-distance calls were, you know, expensive. And this was, you know, a different time. The only communication we had was through, you know, the good old-fashioned letters. And so that's what I wanted. I wanted my novel so authentic that I thought, okay, this is how I'm going to tell the whole, the build-up to the war, Desert Shield, and then Desert Storm. I'm going to do it through letters. And it was also, it was a lot of fun, but it was hard work to make the letters work. And it gives the reader such an intimate look inside to the minds and hearts of some of the key characters. And even Tuck's little son, Austin, who is six, he's a bit precocious for a six-year-old, but his mother helps him write some letters. And you learn a lot of stuff, have a lot of insight through this young boy's mind, where he tells stories about what's happening with, you know, him and his little brother while his daddy's deployed. That was a lot of fun, and we just see the characters through these intimate letters that go back and forth across from the Middle East to Louisiana to Beauregard Air Force Base, where my stories sit. And by the way, for anyone out there who might want to know this, England Air Force Base closed in 1992, and that is my real-life model for my fictitious Beauregard Air Force Base.
Where can people buy The Final Salute, Kathy?
It's available on Amazon. The softcover issue is available for $11.95, and my Kindle version with a new cover with A10 warthogs on the cover, that's $2.99, again on Amazon.
Okay. I have to say, okay, at the end when we dealing with the, interestingly enough, this second death, it was of Wheaties, that suddenly, it's almost like that opens the door for Tuck to release all this built-up pressure. And you do it through a chapter that's a dream sequence in which Tuck confronts his many demons and the ghosts of all of his dead pilot friends who helped let him go. This must have been an incredibly difficult chapter to write.
Yes, Dwight, and thank you for bringing this up. It is my most favorite chapter in the entire book. It's close to the end. It was the hardest chapter to write because I had to get it right, because it is a dream, but I have to let the reader into it without saying, hey, and he had this dream, and the dream is so real. But Tuck is in a chapel, and he's suddenly behind a podium, and Tuck has this thing about preachers, so all of a sudden he's behind this podium in a church scene, and he is confronted with all the dead pilots that he's flown with over his career. And it was a fun scene to write in that I set it up. It's a church scene, but it could just as well have been over at the officers' club on a Friday night in the bar. That's the way that it's kind of that type of setting. And I will say this for anybody who's read the book that knows some of the real people that died in the fighters in F-111s and A-10s, they will recognize I gave some of those real men just brief little, you know, portraits in the scene. But I think it's a moving scene, and I say that because I cried and I laughed when I wrote it. And so hopefully the reader will laugh and cry as well. But it was the hardest scene in the book, but it was the most important scene in the book also.
And well done. So what's your next project?
I'm working on a book called Johnny Come Lately, about a woman named Johnny Kitchen. Her mother's been missing for 23 years, and the story is set in Portion, Texas, kind of in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. And I will tell you this, Dwight, when The Final Salute came out, I thought, that's it. No more military. I'm not writing about the military. I want to do something fresh. Well, guess what? My youngest son is an Army lieutenant, and the military is weaving its way back into the story, and I'm very happy about that. So this story deals with all kinds of issues, but one of the themes is you've got a mother whose father was killed in Vietnam, and all of a sudden now, her youngest son wants to enlist while our nation is at war. And it's been a very moving experience for me trying to bring this story to life.
Well, I'm sure, because you're taking another slice out of your life and putting it into a book.
That's the only way I know how to write my fiction. And I take real life and I use my imagination and I stir it up in a big pot. I call it a gumbo. And hopefully, you know, when the reader will come into the story too. And this is what I want. I want my reader to get lost in the story, to forget they're reading a story, and to get caught up in the lives of my characters.
Yes, well, thank you so much, Kathy, for writing such a fine book. For listeners, it's The Final Salute, available at Amazon and online through e-books. Thank you again, Kathy, and good luck on your next project.
Thank you, Dwight, so much for having me on, and good luck with you. I'm so proud to know you and your books that are coming out this year.
Oh, thank you. This is At Ease at Veterans Radio Network. I'm your host, Dwight Zimmerman. We'll be back after this brief break.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Specialist Roz McGinnis threw his back against a grenade thrown into his Humvee, saving the lives of his crewmates. Details after this.
Pouring rain, it's still dark outside. Your heart starts beating really, really fast. You've never done anything so hard in your life. This is boot camp. This is the real thing now. It's such extreme pain, you don't understand how you can finish. I began to feel that there was no way I was ever going to have my title, U.S. Marine. It takes special inner strength, courage, and desire to do this. I was just thinking, I'm so close. I'm so close. And when I finished, I was like, I'm done. I did it. The moment I will never forget is when this drill instructor that I admired so much comes up to me straight in front of me, put her arm on my shoulder and said, good morning, Marine.
DSC Summer Volkman became a United States Marine. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
On December 4, 2006, McGinnis was manning the turret in the last Humvee of a six-vehicle patrol in northeast Baghdad when an insurgent threw a grenade from the roof of a nearby building. As he stood up to get ready to jump out of the vehicle, as he'd been trained to do, officials say McGinnis realized the other four soldiers in the vehicle did not know where the grenade had landed and did not have enough time to escape. He threw his back against the radio mount and smothered the explosive with his body. McGinnis was killed instantly, while the other four men survived. He was awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously by President Bush on June 2, 2008. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Back to At Ease on Veterans Radio. This is your host, Dwight Zimmerman, and I am happy to welcome my second guest on the program, Carol Joes. Carol, welcome.
Okay. Well, while we're waiting for to try and get Carol Jose back on the line and get back and talking with Dwight here, a few little technical difficulties, we are going to be talking about the formation of the National League of POW-MIA Families, and this is the fascinating story that's going to be on the program this in the next couple of minutes as soon as we get everybody back on the line. All right, You Are Not Forgotten is the story of Evelyn Grubb's husband, Captain Wilmer Newland, better known as Nuke Grubb, and he was shot down over North Vietnam, and everybody thought that he became a prisoner of war and was missing in action. Anyhow, the story is of Evelyn's journey and quest to find out what happened to her husband, because he was reported as being a prisoner, and then she never heard a word from Newt for almost over 7 years, and she wasn't able to get any contact or any information from the United States government, from the Air Force, especially from the North Vietnamese. We all know the story about how they did not necessarily participate in the Geneva Convention. And I don't want to steal the whole story from both of them while we're waiting to get somebody back on the line here, is that the Geneva Convention states that if you have a captured prisoner of war, that you must report that to the home country, and you're supposed to tell them, you know, if they're injured, if they, you know, where they are being held, if they've died, when did they die, how did they die, and they're supposed to arrange for their remains to be sent back to their home country. And numerous countries around the world, this is a result of World War II, that the Geneva Convention came out, and many countries signed this agreement, including the North Vietnamese government, and they did not follow that. And we all know, and we're going to hear many things about that. Okay, I'm going to try again. Here we go. Dwight, have we got you?
Yep, Dale.
All right. I've been doing the thing, and I think we've got Carol on line two, and I'm going to bring her on. Right
okay.
Now. There we go. We got everybody on the line now?
Okay. Carol, are you with us, though? Hello, Carol.
I'm with you. Hello.
Okay. We're sorry about this little glitch here, but welcome to At Ease. And, you know, your book is just this is a memorable story that you and Evelyn wrote about her efforts to try and find out what happened to her husband who was captured and just to find out anything and the difficulty that she encountered. Unfortunately, she passed away during the writing of this book, so could you give us some background of her and how the two of you came to collaborate?
Yes, I had written two other books about POW-MIA situation in Vietnam, and one was called A POW Story, 2,801 Days in Hanoi by Colonel Larry Guarino, who was a prisoner for 7.5 years in Vietnam. And that was about the prison camp. And the second one I had written was about his wife and family, what they did and what it was like after he came back after 7.5 years away. How do you put a marriage back together? I was very interested in Kathy's story of the families and what we go through. Having been a military wife, and my husband was also a pilot and was killed in a crash testing a plane when I was 24. So I understood. It really went straight to my heart when she started talking about the story she wrote. Anyway, I was giving a talk about Evelyn's book because she did not like to give public speeches, but I did. And so Evelyn was attending that, Evelyn Grubb. I had not met her before, and she came up to me afterward and said, please, you're the person I want to write my story. My husband died in captivity. And I said, well, I'd written one about the POW camp and one about the family and what happened after he survived and came home, and my next one was going to be about someone who did not return, who was MIA and did not return, and when she told me her story, I knew that was the third in the trilogy. And so we got together, and unfortunately during the first summer when we were working together and I was going through all the papers, she went to Alaska on a fishing trip, called me from there, and said, I have a breast tumor and I have to fly back. They've said it's malignant. And from then on we worked very, very hard for as long as she was all right to write the book and get it, all the paperwork pulled together and so forth. We were all both hoping that it would be okay, everything would be all right, but unfortunately they hadn't caught it in time, and she passed away in 2005, which left me with an amazing dilemma because getting it published then became an issue. And I really thank God for Art Brown. He's a great guy of Vandermeer Press. You know him, Dwight.
Yes, he published my first book, First Command.
Right.
He's an absolutely wonderful person.
Well, he had published a book of a friend of mine, and I was invited to the dinner, the kickoff dinner, when the book was published, and met Art, and he said, I understand from Andy that you have a manuscript that your co-author died and you've not been able to get it published. And he said, I'd like to see it. And I had it in the car, as it turned out. And so I said, gee, I have it in the trunk of the car. And he said, go get it. And he looked at it, and he called me several days later and said, this is one of the best stories I've ever read. And he said, I'd like to publish it. And those were probably the finest words a writer can hear. It took me 3.5 more years to finish the book and get all of the footnotes done because, of course, without the person, the eyewitness, alive to talk about it, I had to justify everything we put in there with backup from records. Fortunately, we had a lot of them. So that's how it all came about. Evie passed away in December of 2005, and I promised her I would try to get the book published. At the time, I hadn't met Art yet. I didn't meet Art until after Evie had died. So that's how it got to be published. We got Henry Kissinger to write the foreword, which was wonderful, and it won the first prize in history from the Indie Awards in 2010.
Well,
2009,
there.
It was. Yes.
It was when Art told me about your book, he said it was one of the most difficult books he ever read, and it wasn't because of the writing, it was because of the subject matter. It was very powerful, very moving, infuriating. I made sure that Dale got a copy of it, and Dale, you said that blood pressure really rose.
It did. Hi, Carol, and thank you so very much for finishing up this book. It's a magnificent read, not only for civilians, but especially for veterans who weren't captured, although I did know some people that ended up being MIA, unfortunately. But it did. It got my blood pressure up because of the lack of following the laws and following the rules of the Geneva Convention, which is what I was kind of ad-libbing as we were trying to get everybody on the phone again. Is that, you know, the Geneva Convention, in my understanding, is that, you know, if you capture somebody, you let somebody know about it and conditions,
yes,
and all those other things. I'm not going to, you know, steal your thunder on this, but that was what got me so angry, is that all these men that were captured that we didn't know anything about for years, and especially Newt, 7 years, Evie didn't know if he was alive or dead.
Yes, and that is the most dreadful thing I can imagine going through. When I think back on my own life, I know that I was fortunate that when my husband was killed, at least I knew. You know, I had little children, same as she did, and I was 24 years
Carol,
old.
Now, Carol, where can people go to get You Are Not Forgotten?
Well, they can go on Amazon.com. It is on Amazon.com. They can also go call 1-800-551-7776. That's Vandermeer Press. Or go to www.vandermeer.com. Or if they want a discount and they would like a signed book by me, I would be very happy to do that for them. They can go to Yanf Book, YANF, which means You Are Not Forgotten. The title of the book is on every POW/MIA flag you see at the bottom. So just look up at the flag if you forget the title of the book. And the first initial, You Are Not Forgotten, YANFbook.com. You can go and buy it with a credit card, and I will sign it and send it to you. And we will also donate to the Wounded Warriors Program, or Sanctuary Island, as it's called. It's a personal foundation for wounded warriors. We will donate $5 to that. So, of the price.
Now, we have come to think of the National League of Families in a historical context, basically devoted to the Vietnam War. But that's really not correct, because they're involved in this situation with Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. Could you tell us more about that, please?
Okay. Today is the first day, is the third anniversary of his capture. So this is a special day. And this week, Rolling Thunder, that's a Vietnam term also. It was established, the unit that accompanies the Vietnam Wall. But they are really, I belong to them, and that they are really a group that helps all veterans. It doesn't matter what war. And they're wonderful. They just, everything they do is for veterans and for POW/MIA families. And they've gotten very involved in Bo Bergdahl's situation. And this week they've had a full week of activities dedicated to getting Bo Bergdahl released. It's been 3 years now. We understand that there are negotiations taking place between our government and the Afghani insurgency government over a prisoner exchange of some sort, but it has not come to any fruition. So Bo is a young man who was captured at age 26, and he's been held by the Taliban, and there have been four or five videos of him alive. We're praying that he stays that way and that all goes well. And I know the family is, too. And I'd like every military person to write their congressman and reach out to say, look, it's been 3 years. How long can this go on that we can't get him back? There's one POW in Afghanistan, not hundreds, not tens of thousands. It's one guy from Idaho. So if all of you would write your congressman and say, what's going on in the Bo Bergdahl situation? Why can't we get him back? I'd really appreciate that.
as would his family.
Right, and there's
yes.
a, looks like there's a website that people can go to called supportbow.org, Bo, B-O-W-E.
Right, B-O-W-E-B-E-R-G-D-A-H-L is his name. He's a sergeant in the Army.
I want to, we're going to skip our break here and go right to the end of the program. Dwight, so I'll
okay.
just to warn you,
okay.
you don't need to worry about that. But I just wanted to ask Carol about if you could describe for our listeners especially some of the frustration that Evelyn had in trying to find out what happened to her husband.
Well, the military for families back then was very different than it is now, and I'm so happy that it's the way it is now. But the Vietnam War was a very complex issue. People are not happy about the Afghan War right now here, but it's not anything near what was going on back then. And military families were not, there used to be an old saying to us military wives, if we wanted him to have a wife, we'd have issued him one. And that's about how we were treated as wives. I can remember that when my husband was killed, I had to be at the military base within 30 days. I had three little children, 4, 3, and 12 weeks old.
Oh, boy.
You know, and I didn't have any idea where I would go or what I would do. But, you know, you have to make these decisions. It's like, okay, we don't want you around the base anymore because you get up the other wives upset. And this is a terrible thing because no one understands the military family, it puts down roots with other military families. We didn't have careers back then. We couldn't work. We had to, we followed our husbands because they were moved every 6-12 weeks, training in a new plane, doing this, doing that. So what does a wife do when suddenly that doorbell rings and there's the chaplain and his commander telling you that it's all over and you got to get out of here? It's dreadful. We need, and I'm sure we have better survivor benefits and things now than we had in that day. But at that point, Evie went through the same thing. I mean, a taxi driver came in the snow in the winter to her front door. And she had just fed her kids, and they were going to make a tape to Daddy. And the doorbell rang, and there stood a man, stranger to her, holding a yellow ticket in his hand, an envelope, and he said, "Are you Mrs. Grubb?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "I have a telegram," and that's when she went blank. Mm-hmm. And I understand it because when the chaplain tried to talk to me, I was a young girl, and he said, "Is your mother here?" I saw my husband's commander getting out of the car, and I saw the cross on his uniform, and I knew that something horrible had happened, and I said, "Is my husband all right?" And he said, "I need to speak to your mother." I was in shorts and socks, and I was a young girl. And I just grabbed him by the lapels and flung him over a hedge. I never knew I had that kind of strength in my life. But I had to get past him to get to the commander to find out. I mean, your adrenaline is just amazing when that happens. So I know how Evie felt that day. I know what she went through when she went into hallucinations and she was pregnant. And her whole body just reacted. But anyway, he was a prisoner of war. He was alive and well. We have pictures of him. And she didn't hear another word from him ever. And I don't know if you know what that is like. So to this day, what happened to Nuke Grubb is a mystery. He was captured alive and well. He made a tape. We know that. Some of his buddies heard it. But he was never heard from again from the day those pictures were taken. He never got...
If anyone would like to call in and talk to... I have a question for Carol. It's at 877-573-7829.
7825.
Sorry.
That's why we haven't gotten any calls.
I guess.
Okay, get the phone call right, guys. Anyway.
Yes.
So there were terrible things. I mean, North Vietnam had signed the Geneva Conventions. And as Dr. Kissinger told me when we met several times, and he is the nicest man. He really has a wonderful sense of humor. He was just 89 years old a few weeks ago. And he said, Carol, they are the most difficult people I ever tried to negotiate with. He said they were just simply intractable. And he said, I know people think I left people behind. He said, but that's not true. If we knew they were alive, they came home. But you can't, if you don't know where somebody is and you don't know if he's alive or dead, you can't bring him home automatically by snapping your fingers. And they would not release lists. They refused to, even after they brought the main prisoners at home. So it was a very difficult time. And, of course, that was the same time as Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
And President Nixon was totally involved in Watergate and would not even return a call. And Dr. Kissinger said to me, you know, did they think I was president? I couldn't order one troop to move anywhere. I was just a Secretary of State. And I had no authority. So it's really a tough thing. It still bothers him very much. And
now,
we were very fortunate.
Yes, Evelyn wound up becoming more and more involved with the National League of Families, and including becoming its head.
Yeah, she was one of the founders of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us how that whole thing evolved.
Pardon?
Can you explain how her involvement with this, you know, how she got started and...
Sure. Well, she was, of course, alone, and that's what happened to most women. You had nowhere to go except home to your families. At that time, we couldn't live on base or anything when our husbands were missing or killed. So everybody had to go somewhere, and they did not encourage them to meet each other, the women.
Right. I'm going to have to interrupt here for a second, though, but Kathy Rogers has called us back, and she has something that she would like to add to the conversation. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Carol.
Yes.
I had to call back in. I am so moved by your testimony about your own story about losing your husband when you were 24, and I'm crying now as I'm listening to the program. I just wanted to say hello.
Oh,
and
Kathy,
I'm
thank
so
you.
Touched
it's great to hear from another military wife who understands.
And I just wanted to say hello.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I hope you'll read the book. It's a great book for women and families.
I will. Okay, I'll take myself off
women.
The air. Bye.
Thank you. And this is Dale, and I totally agree. This is a book that for military families, but it's really important for civilians, and especially for members of the generation of the 60s and 70s. This gave me such insight, and I was involved in it as
mm-hmm.
to what was going on and why I was so frustrated at the time, and why I got to go talk to my doctor this week, I think.
Yeah,
hey, take the book with you. So,
it was really that powerful, Carol. And again, I want to thank you for it.
Well, I have to tell you what Don Shepard, Major General Don Shepard, the U.S. Air Force.
Mm-hmm. We know Don. On. We know Don. He's
oh, I know.
Program.
You know Don. Okay. Well, Don called me up and he said, Carol, you know, I knew this story when you first told me about it. And you say right up front, you know, that he dies. And or he comes home, his remains come home. We don't know how he died. And he said, yet all the way through the book, I kept hoping it was going to be a Cinderella ending, you know, for her.
I agree
that he was going to come home. But it, of course, you know, not every fairy tale has a happily ever after ending. And unfortunately, he was never heard from again. And then later, they released his remains when Henry Kissinger put tremendous pressure on them. He got about 13 of them that were all buried in one spot, which we show the graves and everything in the book. What I really have to thank Art for, too, is the art in the book. There are many, many pictures, and he put them in the place where they happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was it's a beautiful book, and I like nice books, and I was very proud that he did that book so beautifully. And
it's not common for writers to praise their publishers, but Art is definitely one of the good people that way. He's a former Navy, retired from the Navy, and has a very good... he is a writer's publisher. There's no two ways about that. So, Art, if you're listening...
I hope he is. And you know, when Evie died, I didn't get any, you know, publishers immediately pulled back, the big publishers. And they said, no, we can't do it because she's dead. But then when I got Henry Kissinger to write the foreword, suddenly they were back. It's all about names and you know, recognition of names and all of that. And I thought, no, Art had already, Evie died in December, and I met Art in January, and he had already said, I love that book. I was so emotionally wrung out when I finished it. I want to publish it. And I thought, no, I'm not going to go back with one of these others because Art is a good guy. And I know he'll do right by the book and by Evie. I just knew. And he
mm-hmm. did. I agree with you.
Anyway. You agree with me, yes.
We've got about a minute and a half, Dwight.
Okay. Well, Carol, if for civilians who are hearing about this for the first time, what sort of message do you want to pass on to them?
Well, I think it will give them a bigger understanding of what was going on in this country, because it is a book about the history of that period of time, a decade of that period of time. And it tells you how life, you know, unfolds in the military. As I say, every Cinderella story is not a happy ending. And his last tape to his wife, Evie, whom he adored, said, "We'll be together again someday, my darling, one of these days." And one of these days took 40 years when her sons buried her with her, with their dad. I'm sorry, I get choked up every once in a while about this. They buried her with their dad on the same day, April 4th, that he was, that she got his body back and buried it, his remains. And that was also the same date that my husband was killed, April 4th, as it turned out. Anyway, she was buried at Arlington Cemetery, and they were together again after 40 years. So it was a very special time. And it's a beautiful story. It's of love and hardship.
Carol, thank you so much for being our guest. Her book is You Are Not Forgotten. And good luck on your next project.
Well, I'd love to come back sometime and tell you about the POW/MIA flag and the project I'm working on now.
We will definitely book you for that. We'll talk with you later on that. Thank you again.
Okay. That's great. Thank you so much, Dwight and Dale. It was great to meet both of you, and thank you to your audience for listening and having the patience to listen.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dwight, and our audience. You are dismissed.
Okay.